Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
June is a very busy month in the sports world, with both the NBA and Stanley Cup Finals being decided, the Major League Baseball season going into its third month, the Collegiate Baseball and Softball World Series being held, and major championships for golf and tennis taking place. Hello, I'm Matt Bush, the news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. I also help produce Going Deep, and in today's episode, I speak with the Shoups about some of the headlines in the sports world as June 2018 arrives. This was initially recorded as a Facebook Live for the BPR Facebook page, and we start our discussion with a sport that's in its off-season on the field, but never in its off-season in the news, the NFL, and the new policy regarding players standing for the national anthem. So the policy that owners approved, supposedly unanimously, but we don't actually know that, is that players will have to stand if they're on the field. Now, if they don't want to stand, they can stand in the locker room during the anthem. Your immediate thoughts on this?
Well, I have a few thoughts. I'm certainly not the only one to voice kind of a little bit of befuddlement about why they even felt like they needed to do this. It was something that was sort of dying down, and I understand that, you know, they had, the NFL was perhaps feeling some pressure from some quadrants of their fan base, but there's some question as to kind of why they had to poke the hornet's nest again right now. People weren't, this was not
in some ways, this kind of, if they wanted the issue to go away, then this sort of kind of reignited it. If it was going away,
and
if they didn't realize they had done that inadvertently, they put it right back in the front page.
Right, and it shows a very high degree of tone deafness about the conversation in our country right now about what is patriotism, what is freedom, and what are the things that our servicemen and women have died for, if it's not the right to voice your opposition and dissent in this country. That's part of what makes us a great country. And particularly around, you know, the phenomena, the dynamic of black and brown-bodied people voicing their dissent, it shows a high degree of tone deafness, I think. But, you know, they're a marketing machine, so I'm sure they knew that this would appeal to the people they wanted to appeal to. But it certainly, on the face at least, looks like they've sided with President Trump and said, you know, we also agree that respect looks like this. This is what it looks like. It looks like standing for the anthem and being quiet about your dissent in this country.
Well, it's interesting to me because, as you said, President Trump and the NFL has said this is what respect looks like. When Colin Kaepernick initially did his first protest, he sat on the bench. He sat during the national anthem. And his protest was about police brutality and how police treat people of color unfairly. And he was trying to draw attention to it. He certainly did that.
I don't know. That's debatable.
Well, he certainly drew attention to it.
He drew attention to this anthem.
I mean, this conversation has ignited. But it was actually a Green Beret, a guy named Nett Boyer, who was a long snapper for the Seattle Seahawks and was also a Green Beret in the service, who wrote a letter to Colin Kaepernick and said, "I get where you're coming from. Can I talk to you?" And Colin Kaepernick returned it immediately, and they got together and visited. And it was a Green Beret, Nate Boyer, an NFL player and former Green Beret, who told him, in the military, what we do for respect is we'll take a knee. And there's not a more reverent position in the military than taking a knee, especially when you're at, you know, the grave of a fallen comrade. And so when people use the words respect and this is what respect looks like, I think Colin Kaepernick was being very intentional, was being very trying to do this protest in a way that's very respectful. And nobody talks about that, in my opinion, enough. It was a Green Beret who told him, this is the most reverential position you can take.
Well, but nothing about the way this kind of issue has unfolded has really gotten at what Colin Kaepernick was trying to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's become about the anthem. It's become about the flag. It's become about patriotism. You don't hear people talking about violence against, about state-sanctioned violence against black and brown people. That hasn't been what the conversation has been. And also, the other thing, the other red herring that's out there with this is Colin Kaepernick's own employment status with the NFL.
And now his former teammate, Eric Reid, same problem, was one of the people who helped him start that, is also unsigned this offseason.
Yeah. Look, it's wrong, it's unfair, but he won't be the first person who, you know, stood up and said what he thought and couldn't get a job. Mm-hmm. I mean, we understand that dynamic. And that's the price you pay sometimes. And I think, Colin Kaepernick's using that as a part of his, you know, kind of case in point of the dynamics mm-hmm. of the business. But I have a feeling if he were in this room, he'd say, you know what, that's not what I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about my job. I want to talk about what it's like to be a person of color in this country. And we've missed an opportunity for that conversation. And I feel when I look at, like, the players on Twitter and some of the conversations from sports broadcasters and stuff, I think people are kind of starting to – I think the NFL bringing this back up has added a finer point to some of the rebuttals to that. Like, you know what? Then we're going to organize and maybe we're going to boycott some games.
Mm-hmm. And there's discussion of trying to get a quarter of players right now to boycott.
To not play. Mm-hmm. And also some are talking about just not coming out of the – locker room, which is allowed. You know, President Trump's already come back and said, if you don't come out of the locker room, that's wrong too.
And I think something to discuss about that is almost now, as a fan or as a player or as a broadcaster, whomever, you can sit there during the national anthem and see who's on the field, take the photo, and then mm-hmm. go down and check off, oh, this person was here, this person wasn't, and all that.
Yeah.
There's so many ways that can go with. I think one thing I'd like to ask you, John, is this create divisions within a locker room, within a team?
Well, I think anything can create divisions within a locker room.
Politics and religion are pretty good at that.
Politics and religion are good at that. But really, I have not spoken to a player that is against a teammate taking a knee. Having said that, I've spoken to players that have said they were not going to take a knee. They were going to stand. I, myself, chose to stand for the national anthem at our games this year at A.C. Reynolds High School. So I think that it can divide a locker room. I don't think that it is. I think players generally respect the kneeling for a national anthem. As I said, it comes from a respectful beginning with the Green Beret. What I think is really interesting is the NFL has come out and said this was a unanimous vote in favor of the NFL's position is we're all going to stand. Well, as I understand it, it was more of a voice vote that kind of surprised some of the people in the room that it got to a voice vote so fast. And it was all opposed and nobody said nay, because I think people were still kind of trying to process what was going on, and the vote then passed. It's odd to me that a vote that passed unanimously just a few days after The owner of the New York Jets has said, I, for one, will pay the fine of any player on our team that decides to take a knee. That doesn't sound very unanimous to me. And as you hear the rumblings going around, I think some of the owners in the league, I wouldn't say that it's a 32-0 in favor of this position for the NFL. And so I actually am not convinced that this is all the way done yet.
Well, but even if there are a few dissenting owners, I would not be surprised if most of the owners, that's who's divided, the players and the owners. Maybe it's not the players and the players,
right.
But there are plenty of owners who, especially in more conservative areas of our country, that demographic plays out. The teams in more conservative areas, the owners are more like, get out there and stand up.
Right, and I think maybe two that have been the most vocal against this policy would be New York Jets and the city of New York, and San Francisco would be considered to the more liberal parts of the country.
Yeah. So you see who they're, we know who
they're business, and remember, they are businesses in the end. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? In terms of their status as a business, it's their prerogative to have expectations for what their employees do. And those men who are siding with the players, they're not stupid. They understand what chemistry on the team is important. They understand, like, the morale of their players, feeling like that owner is with them. That's important. And you see some of the disgruntlement just on social media from some players who really, they didn't need another reason to feel like the NFL doesn't care about them as people. And this has really been an insult. I think it's interesting, too, just to think about how subjective this term respect and disrespectful is, and how it, I hear echoes in that that term, the way the kind of dominant culture in our country has silenced dissent around other things, like Supreme Court decision about what is pornography. Well, anybody, a rational person knows what's pornography. Well, really? What is whiteness? Well, rational man is the way they said it, would know a white person when they see them. And some of the owner's rhetoric has been the same. Anybody who is a good patriot or American knows disrespect when they see it. And I think where we are right now, that kind of blanket, like, well, you know what I'm talking about, it just doesn't have the same social currency anymore, I don't think.
It makes me think of an interesting scenario that I experienced while I was at the University of North Carolina. We usually traveled in sweatsuits, nice sweatsuits given to us by Nike, but in sweatsuits on a plane. And one of the reasons we did that is because all the players didn't have nice suits necessarily or the same quality. But one game a year, we did get dressed up. We called it a dress-up game. And players could go rent suits. Players could go get, different things. But the guideline was dress like you're going to church. Dress in your Sunday best. And that was our head coach, Coach Davis's mantra. And I'll never forget, some of the administrators that got on the plane with us were shocked at how some of these players were dressed. And we as coaches were like, oh, hey, you look great. That's awesome. And their version of dressing for Sunday or dressing your Sunday best was, many of the players' versions of that or interpretation of looking your best, dressing respectfully, was much different than the administration's version of dressing your best or dressing respectfully. And it was a scenario that I never...
And who gets to say which one is right?
Right. Who gets to say which one is right? Because these players poured, they really paid a lot of attention. They really were very intentional about how they were dressing. It just wasn't how some of the white old administrators from North Carolina dressed when they got on a plane.
Or went to church.
But I thought they looked great.
Well, we're going to pivot here a little bit, talking earlier about the business of sports, something that is going to have an unseen impact right now. It's going to have some kind of impact, but we'll find out what you think of the impact on this is. And that's the coming proliferation in the United States of legalized sports betting, a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that dealt with a case that came from the state of New Jersey, where the former governor, Chris Christie, was trying to get legalized sports betting in that state. The Supreme Court ruled in New Jersey's favor. All these other states had passed laws saying, well, if legalized sports betting is okay outside of the state of Nevada in the United States, these states that already had casinos, Pennsylvania, Delaware examples, we'll start having legalized sports gambling. We'll have sports books in our casinos in our states. That could just explode the amount of sports gambling legalized again that's happening in the United States. The NFL being the most popular and being the most gambled on, and I would certainly argue those are certainly related, we'll see a huge impact on this, but that question, but all sports definitely will. So again, your thoughts. When we have legalized gambling in stadiums, now this happens in one, which we're going to get to already, but when we have that in stadiums, is that at all going to change really what happens?
I think it's going to change it a great deal. I think there's a lot of levels to this. The first is what the Supreme Court didn't necessarily legalize gambling everywhere. The Supreme Court said each state can make that decision.
It is no longer just Nevada's.
Right. So the state of North Carolina, where we are, can make the decision whether to legalize gambling or not. North Carolina has a more conservative bent in many regards and has been listed as one of the states that hasn't even started the process of investigating what that would look like. Mm-hmm. However, Virginia, Tennessee, and South Carolina have. And those are all states surrounding North Carolina. And so if the surrounding states start legalizing gambling, you can bet that your state is going to end up legalizing it as well. Otherwise, everybody in Charlotte is going to travel down to Rock Hill, South Carolina to watch the games and gamble on it. Now, your question was specifically about
towards the games itself, I guess. Well, you had the stadiums, but the games itself. We're 99 years removed from the most famous incident, the 1919 World Series, involving players affecting the outcome of games proven, well, not actually proven, but, you know, the one that has been decided, at least the most famous, was the 1919 World Series, that they were taking money from gamblers and then throwing the games and all that. Is this really going to change as much? Because one thing you guys have talked about on several shows is prohibition, be it on paying players in the NCAA, be it on drugs, be it on alcohol, be it on many things. All this gambling's going on now, without question.
Right.
It's just not going on in what we would say legal arenas.
Right.
So again, making this legalized, does that really change the games that much? The stadium experience, I'm sure it would, but does it really change the games that much? Or are we so far removed from this one very famous incident it's not going to happen?
Well, and I'll say there's been more incidents than just that.
Right. That's the most famous. Yeah. I mean, there's been several others.
But in our lifetimes, there have been, whether it's Boston College or Notre Dame or Tulane basketball, there have been college athletes who have been accused and convicted of point shaving.
Right, and in professional, there's Pete Rose. There's tennis players.
There's the wonderful story of Bobby Lane. And the reason, now you're a Pittsburgh guy.
I know Bobby Lane.
Do you know why Bobby Lane was traded to the Pittsburgh Steelers?
Far away.
His last year with the Detroit Lions, were driving in the fourth quarter to beat the New York Giants. And they were down tight, like around the 12-yard line, getting inside the 10. And the head coach for the Detroit Lions sends out the field goal team because they're down two. The Detroit Lions are down two to the New York Giants. The field goal kicker comes out, and Bobby Lane sends the field goal kicker back to the sideline. Bobby Lane calls a pass, throws the pass, incomplete, and the Lions lose the game by two. When he comes to the sideline, the head coach says to him, "What are you doing? I sent out the field goal team. We'd have won the game. We only needed 3 points." He said, "No, we needed to win that game by 4 points." The next day, he was traded. The next day, he was traded to the Pittsburgh Steelers. That is told to me by an old Detroit Lions football player. So,
irrevocably changed that franchise, too. They've never won a championship since he was traded.
The thing that I think will be interesting is what the in-game experience might be like with your phone.
Mm-hmm. The amount of prop betting that could go on, like, all right, third and ten, here are your odds of whether this team's going to convert this third down or not. Will this kicker make this 50-yard field goal?
Exactly.
Will they run or pass? Simple things.
Yeah. And you're going to have thousands upon thousands of bets being made in that stadium on phones, and you're going to have to be at the stadium to make some of those bets, and so that's going to draw the crowd there, and so. I've often thought to myself, as a play caller in the NFL, I've often thought, boy, I could make a lot of money, you know, doing something. But now whenever you think about just how much people will be gambling, the thing that struck me is how much people will bet on anything.
Yes.
I mean, they'll bet on the coin toss. Mm-hmm. They'll bet on is the first play of the game a run or a pass?
Around Super Bowl time, the prop bets that come out, how long will the national anthem take? Will it be under 2 minutes or over 2 minutes? Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Those things, yeah. Now those are going to go from, a few hundred people betting to thousands of people betting instantly over your phone. And it'll change it a little bit. It'll change it a little bit. And I was never, I'd love to sit here and say I was never aware of what the point spread was while I called a game in the NFL.
We were aware because of death threats. Yeah,
but you're aware just because, we were 13-3 in 2001 in Chicago, but we were 8-8 against the spread. And hell, I saw myself hung in effigy,
For those who would like, that would be the Shoops Talk Part 2 episode where we discussed, it was your most successful season as a coordinator in the pros. You went 13-3, but you said you got calls. You got calls from even your own dad saying
fantasy
football. But I guess to talk about gambling and take it from a moral perspective of this, if this is proliferated that we can do it so simply right from our phone.
Well, there's a couple.
What does that bring to society?
There's three things that I would say from a kind of moral, ethical perspective. One, you look at the rhetoric of a lot of the kind of high-up officials in our major leagues, and all of them, at least for appearances' sake, have come out with their furrowed brow of, like, we really want to protect the integrity of our games, you know? So they for them, there is this important kind of foil to gambling off the chain, that somehow we must stake a claim for integrity. And so I want to watch how that plays out because I don't know what they mean by that. Mm-hmm. You mean that people can trust that it's a fair outcome?
Sure.
I mean, people already, if their team is losing, people think the referees are on the dole.
They already think that now.
Exactly. That's already. So is that going to be improved at all just because we have regulated legal gambling? I don't know, because that's already a part of the psyche. Two is statistics and studies and everything tell us that gambling is an addiction. It's not just a compulsion. Mm-hmm. It's not just a lack of impulse control, but it is addictive. And that, that the people who tend to fall prey to some of those addictive behaviors are, often people that don't have the reserves to absorb the impact of that in their lives. It feels a little bit like some kind of regressive way to profit off of people's moral weaknesses or desperation. So that's another level that as kind of from an ethical perspective, where did somebody said, well, the NFL should help pay for, Gamblers Anonymous, or they should And, you know, John's point was, well, they don't pay for Alcoholics Anonymous and everybody there's drunk, sure. You know. Right. I mean, there's not a lot of healthy behavior going on mm-hmm. in a stadium anyway. And then the third thing is just kind of how this just kind of gives into this obsession that our country has with sports. So mm-hmm. this is going to not help people put their stuff down and go outside and throw the ball with their kids. Mm-hmm. It's going to exacerbate some of that already kind of, you know, just kind of fixation on every play, the stats, mm-hmm. the line.
It's make
that
fantasy
stuff.
Football look very eager.
Exactly.
Really.
Fantasy football, all of those things, all the apps and things that people already have that are taking them out of relationship with their mm-hmm. their kind of actual lives. Mm-hmm. So from an ethical perspective, I don't think any of that really figures on the radar of you know, a team owner mm-hmm. or gambling, people who are really going to profit from the gambling industry taking off. But from my perspective as an ethicist and a theologian and a minister mm-hmm. Who works with human beings who are really struggling to feel connected to other human beings and mm-hmm. feel connected to the world around them. I don't feel like it's a healthy direction for us to go in as a mm-hmm. society, but I don't think that counts for much. That's my jaded viewpoint.
Is this different? This particular issue is gambling as a vice. Is that a different vice than something like alcohol or marijuana or some of the many other vices that are out there? Is it any different?
I mean, it depends on who you ask. In the theological tradition that gave birth to my kind of reform tradition, gambling was seen as of the devil. I mean, because you don't make money off of money. Sure. You shouldn't earn interest in a bank account either. You know, that was mm-hmm. the kind of strict Calvinist understanding of what it meant to work and what it meant to let your money do what it would do for you, but not to become an idol in your life. So it depends on who you ask. I don't look at sin in terms of little behaviors. Mm-hmm. I look at it as a condition of estrangement. So alcohol, marijuana, pornography, whatever it is, if it takes you out of relationship with a higher power or with mm-hmm. other human beings, or even with yourself in a healthy way, then that's a condition of estrangement. And so in that way, I think it is does mm-hmm. have a threatening effect because of the way it kind of takes us out of relationship with yeah. our lives.
You know, it's interesting to me because the Vegas Golden Knights,
which
is
going to go
team.
Into this, yeah. this is the only place where you can do gambling, is that's in Vegas on the hockey team. They're in the yeah. Stanley Cup Finals in their first year, and we're going to get into a little more about that. Yeah. But and if gambling in your arena is seen as a sign of winning, and they've done it in their first year of existence, boy, every team's going to fall over themselves for it. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, can you imagine an arena with 20,000 watching the game mm-hmm. and they're betting as the game is going on from their phone? Mm-hmm. They do this now in Vegas. They do this on who will take the next slap shot, who mm-hmm. will score the next goal. Mm-hmm. And I could see that in football, where any time that there's crowds of people, we think of NFL crowds of 80,000, mm-hmm. of college football stadiums of, you know, 100,000. And I could see the numbers getting staggering. But I wonder if there's an app on your phone that just has everybody at this game can log on to, mm-hmm. what would keep it from, you know, there's going to be 20,000 people when Pisgah plays Tuscola this fall as well. Mm-hmm. They have the biggest 50-50 raffle this side of the Mesa.
Well, again, going to that, every high school does a 50-50 raffle, right?
You're exactly right. If you come to an A.C. Reynolds game on a Friday night, there'll be 5,000 to 8,000 people there watching our team play. What's to keep them from getting on an app and gambling to start wherever crowds of people gather? gambling
theological.
Will be able to take place. And so I think we think of it, or I should say, I think of it as that's kind of cool whenever, if I was at a hockey game, that's kind of cool if I was at the basketball game, who's going to get the next three? All of a sudden you say to me, I'm at a high school football game. I don't know that I feel the same about it.
Sure.
I feel a little bit different. I don't know exactly why that is, but I think I do.
Well, is it easier for people to have kind of a conflict of assignment with that? Like, if it's that easy, doesn't it get easier for somebody to go, hey, Junior, you know, is a 16-year-old quarterback, like, yeah, how about you just throw that in the dirt a couple times for me?
Yeah, perhaps. Those are, as we're talking about it now, that's something that just kind of popped into my head. Perhaps, for sure. Or a coach to say, if we ever have a 3rd and 10, bet on us, you know, not to get it, and I can make sure we don't convert 3rd and 10s. I don't know how that would work.
So we'll go a bit to the lightning round here and do some quick hits, I guess you could say. One of them will go back to what we were saying before. So the one place you can do this now is in Las Vegas, the Vegas Golden Knights, in their first year of existence, the first professional team in that city in the major four leagues. They're in the Stanley Cup Finals. They're playing for the championship. They won the first game. They're playing the Washington Capitals, who, of the four major sports leagues, you probably put them in the top 10 of teams that have tortured their fans. Yes. I know this, having lived in D.C. for 10 years and have several friends who are Capitals fans. That team has tortured its fans about as well as any other team I can think of. Just really to go on about fandom, for the Capitals fans, this is such a big moment for them that they are there. For the Vegas fans, they probably really don't know what it's like, right? As a fan, and as your analysis of it, as fans, we are living out the fantasies in our head. We are seeking redemption. How do those two teams kind of go with that?
Well, one of the things that makes this matchup so interesting is that Las Vegas, I mean, you can look at it as like the, you know, newly minted team. People don't even know the rules of hockey that are watching it. But that's a city that just went through a massacre, you know, and this team really sees itself as healing that city. Mm-hmm. And people feel that way about it too. They're fans because they're giving them something to feel good about. They're giving them something to come together about. And that whole idea of redemption, that something is working out the way they hoped it would. Mm-hmm. It is renewing their faith in the universe. So in that sense, there are so many more layers to it than just a sports team and fans jumping on a bandwagon like, hey, our team's winning. I don't even know what they're playing. What's the score? But hey, our team's winning and our city has been in deep grief and fear and trauma. And this is something to feel joyful about. And we're jumping up and down and we're hugging total strangers. Right.
And it's the same dynamic that I think happened in Houston with the Astros after the floods and storms.
And Katrina when the Saints won after that.
Yeah, so if the Vegas Golden Knights win the Stanley Cup in their first year of existence, your old friend John Gruden's going to be under a lot of pressure in 2 years when the Raiders show up there. He better win the Super Bowl in his first year, too, if the Golden Knights set this precedent.
You know, it's interesting because I remember in 1996, I was with the Carolina Panthers, and it was their second year in existence. And in their second year in existence, we went to the NFC Championship game and lost a tight game to Brett Favre, who went on to win the Super Bowl. And I remember, I was just a 26-year-old coach, and I remember thinking, ah, nuts, we didn't get there to the Super Bowl this year, but man, we'll get back. How hard it is to get there and to do it in your first year. We did it in our second year.
And so did the
Jaguars. I think there was really a part of me that didn't realize how hard it really was. And I wonder if the people in that organization, I know there's veterans on that team, but just the people that work at that organization and the fans, don't really realize how hard it is. You better enjoy this because there's no guarantee.
You always have to enjoy it when it happens.
That's another part of the appeal, though. A lot, and I remember this with the Carolina Panthers. that story, that narrative of nobody else wanted us. We're the throwaway players. Mm-hmm. We're the ones that everybody said were washed up and done. And look, we're going to win this championship. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some of the players for the Las Vegas team talking like that. Like, everybody's counted us out. We want to stay the underdog. All these players got picked up off the street. Mm-hmm. And that narrative also, Americans love that. Mm-hmm. That you can be, nobody thought you were any good. And now you're the winner.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well, @ShoopsGoingDeep.